God, I mean. So let's go ahead and get started. There's a flyer going around. And
I know Professor Manley's already told you guys about this, so I'll be quick. I'm Peter. I'm president of the Society of Physics Students, and we offer free tutoring for anyone in any physics class, but especially for the intro physics classes. That's Monday through Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. in the POA. There's usually at least three tutors there, so there's a lot of people can go and get help. So we passed around a flyer that has all the information on it. I'll leave this bundle down here at the bottom in case you came in afterwards and didn't get one, and I hope to see you there.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really, really good of them to do that, and it's actually sort of an interesting thing if you're the physicist in there, because you get a random assortment of questions from people, EM, thermo, et cetera, all the courses that are going on, so have a little sympathy when you come to them, give them a chance to sort of regroup and think, okay, what course is this sort of thing. I do find that very often with this class, somewhere mid-semester, I have somebody wondering where in the world the POA library is. It's in BNL on the third floor. Okay, it's the physics library. I forget what POA stands for, but that's what we call it. So it's not the PAS library. It's the POA library. Sorry about that. How are workshops going so far? A few of you should have had them. Hello. Wow. That sucks. I have to reboot. Sorry about that. Taking advantage of that. In addition, I've asked the CA to schedule slots an hour and a half each scattered through the week, so you can see that we have a whole bunch of them scattered through the week in different places. This information is also on the class website, and I think we have at least one more that's going to get added in. Well, the bad news for the day was someone emailed me asking if I was sure about the final exam time, and I went and I looked, and sure enough, there's a mistake in the syllables, and I have no idea how that happened, because in fact, I know to triple check that, so I don't know whether I was looking at the wrong year or what, but at any rate, it is Thursday, December 19th, please make a note of that, not Wednesday, December 18th. Okay. Same time, and I haven't bothered to look where the location is yet, but I'll find that. Okay, any issues? All right, so last time, in the last couple of classes, we've been looking at one-dimensional motion, and in one-dimensional motion, you do have direction. You can go this way or that way. And you can specify that using the algebraic sign. So things are relatively easy in that way. For three-dimensional motion, life is not quite so simple because the direction can be very complicated. So, But we still have to have direction because we want to analyze motion and other quantities to have both magnitude and direction. So we have to figure out how to do it. The way that we will typically do it is to take a full three-dimensional problem and break it down into multiple one-dimensional problems and then sort of pull it back together. But having said that, we have to be able to, again, handle the full three-dimensional thing. So that means that we need more than just numbers. So typically, we have different kinds of quantities that you can use. One of those quantities are basically what we're used to as numbers. So if you want to measure temperature, all you need is a number that does that. You know, you might map it into some three-dimensional space. The temperature here is 65, here is 68, here is 72. You know, you can play that game, but all you need is a number. And in physics, we call those numbers scalars. And those are just numbers, and we would say they have only magnitude. But if you want to specify both a magnitude and a direction, then we use something which we call vectors. And these have both magnitude and direction. And there are many different ways to specify vectors. The simplest way is to think of them as nothing but a little arrow at some point in space. So here, for example, is a vector. It has both a magnitude, which you can take by being determined by the length of this arrow, and it has a direction, which is the direction of the arrow. Okay? And it turns out that this vector is this vector. Even if I move it over here or over here, it still has the same magnitude and direction. So these are all equivalent. Okay? So you can be doing some physics problem and have a vector in some part of that problem, and you can mentally or with a pencil in your drawings actually move it. It's still the equivalent vector. Okay, so it has sort of a physical presence in a sense that a number doesn't, because it has this direction. So you can actually visualize it as an arrow. In all of the equations that I will write, and in many books, most books, the vector is signified by some letter or whatever you're using to represent it, with a little arrow on the top. Some books will boldface it, usually with an arrow, but maybe not always. So just be careful with that. So vectors have direction and magnitude. So you can imagine having a vector within some coordinate system. So there's our little arrow out in three space, okay, and we have three dimensions here. We'll call this our x-axis, this our y-axis, and this our z-axis. And you can imagine that we can literally define our vector by the point that's right there, because that point lies at a position Hold on a sec, gotta get this right. That point is defined by its position in 3-space, which you get from 3 numbers. So you can get it from the distance that you are in x. I'm going to call this vector A. And the distance that we go out in x to get to that point, which I'll call AX, AY, AC. So it has that point here, has the 3 coordinates, AX, AY, AZ. So that means that we go out AX, we go out this way, AZ, and we go up this way, AY. Okay? And we can draw the arrow then to go from the origin to that point. So we can represent any vector as 3 numbers. And the length of the vector we signify we put an absolute value around that vector, and this is what we call the magnitude. This is one number and it has no direction. And it's always positive. So it's just the length regardless. My arm is so many millimeters long regardless of how I have it pointed. Right? So if we have a vector, we know it has basically 2 fundamental pieces. One piece is its magnitude, the other piece is its direction. So this tells us how to get the magnitude and get to measure the length, which we'll talk about how we calculate soon enough. But we also want to have a measure of simply its direction, with the length basically not being important. So I'm going to define that using a thing which we call the unit vector. And if you're already asleep, I want you to wake up, because about halfway through the semester, I always get a handful of people coming in and have no idea what a unit vector is, and yet we've been using them for a month and a half, and you just sort of wonder, what have you been doing? So this is actually important, and it's also one of the fuzzier parts of today's lecture for some reason I find. The unit vector is a vector with unit magnitude, unit being 1, whatever units you're in, it's just a unit magnitude of 1, in the same direction as the vector that you're overall discussing. So if I have vector A that's in this direction, a unit vector would be a vector with magnitude 1 in that same direction. So that way, when you do a population with it, the magnitude doesn't do anything, it's just a 1. But the direction is still there. Okay? So I can define that by taking the vector and dividing it by the magnitude of the vector. So that way I divide out the magnitude. This gives direction of A with magnitude 1. This is a pain in the butt to write all the time, so we have a shorthand that we use where we take the A and we give it this kind of line over it, and we call this A hat. Okay. So any vector hat is a unit vector in that vector's direction. So there are lots of different ways to symbolize vectors or to discuss them, and we'll go through a whole bunch of them soon. But a way to think about it is, we've talked about this is the vector A. It is also the same thing as three numbers, which represent the three components of that vector. And we'll come back and do plus other representations in a moment. So, we have to be able to do mathematical operations with vectors. And you have to remember that vectors are not numbers. So that means the algebra and how you do it and things, even the operations that you can do, are a little bit different. It's a bit of a different piece. And it may seem, it will seem for the vast majority of you, for about the first half of this class probably, that, you'll learn to use vectors because we're going to force the issue. But you'll sort of think of it as an absurd complication to a lot of the stuff that we seem to be doing. Okay? In the end, as you get comfortable with them, you'll realize that the vector description of the physical phenomenon is the simplest possible way of actually describing it. And you do need more than the numbers. But one of the things to bear in mind later in the course is we're going to look at a couple of phenomena, particularly one called precession, which basically is this explanation of that bicycle wheel that I did the first day, where it doesn't fall but it goes sideways. We're going to derive that using vectors. And you look at it and you're going to see exactly what the vector equation tells you is going to happen. But it mentally makes no sense. Okay? So one of the things that I think is fundamentally very cool about this business is that mathematics is extraordinarily powerful. And you can actually use the mathematics to, in a sense, understand or see things about nature that your mind really isn't set up to deal with. And it's one of the reasons that we use math. So you'll see really one example of that today. This whole vector thing is extremely powerful. So I think that's a little bit my way of apologizing that we have to go through all this mud with vectors initially, but you'll find in the end that it's really absolutely necessary. And there's good reasons for it. At any rate, they aren't numbers, so you can't treat them as numbers. They have both direction and magnitude. So we need to figure out how to deal with them. Let me see the order I want to do this. So we did this example last class where we had a river and we had a boat on a river, right? And the river's flowing, so if the boat's motor isn't working, it just flows this way with the river. If the river isn't flowing, if it's just a lake and you have the boat headed this way, you go like this. And then if you have the boat motor going this way and the river flowing that way, you effectively are adding together two things that have both direction and magnitude. And what you get is something like this, which is not that, and it's not this. It's a different thing altogether. And it is dependent on which of those, both the magnitude of this, right? If the magnitude of the river flowing is really big, then it's more over this way, right? If it's very slow, then I almost go straight this way. And it depends on the direction of the two vectors. So it's a complicated thing. So often, we're going to see how to analytically calculate these things in detail as part of the fun for this class. But before we do that, I want you to get a sense of how you can add these things together graphically, because you're going to want to be able to do that all the time in order to sort of mentally check whether what you're doing makes any sense. Even though you won't usually have the opportunity to, say, give an answer using a graphical sort of thing, you'll want to be able to do it in your head. So let's look at an operation on vectors. Vector addition. And in this case, I want to do it graphically. So if I have, say, a vector A, which I will represent with, say, this arrow, and I want to add that to a vector B, which I'll just represent, say, with this arrow, so there are our two vectors, then it's equal to a vector C, and what would that vector look like? And the way that you do it is you take your first vector, and then you take your second vector, and you take your second vector and you put it so that the tail of the second vector juts up against the head of the first vector. And I haven't changed any directions here, because if I do that, I'm no longer dealing with the two vectors that I started with. Okay? So I take this one, and then I take that one and add it to it, like so, graphically. And then it turns out that this vector C is the vector that goes from the tail of the first one to the head of the second one. So vector C turns out to be a vector that looks something like that. You have to preserve the magnitude and direction as you do that. And generally speaking, when you take two vectors and you add them together like that, we have a special name for what you come up with, and we call it the resultant. Note that I could take B and add it to A. So now I have, this is B plus A. And that turns out to also be C. So A plus B is equal to B plus A. In other words, in vector algebra, addition is commutative. It doesn't care about the order. You okay with this? Yes?
When you draw the vector so that the head and tail are together.
Yes, when you draw the vector C, it has to go from the start of the first vector to the end of the second vector. So, yeah, head to tail. Anything else? Okay. multiply a vector by a constant, and all that really does is give me a vector with a magnitude which has been multiplied by that constant. So it's a little bit off. So a constant times a vector. Now this is a vector, right? Because it has magnitude and direction. So I then tell you that it is something of this magnitude, because I have these lines. So I've increased the magnitude by the factor c. But now because this is a vector, I also have to tell you the direction on this side, because it has to be in the column. And so I tell you it's in the same direction as a. I could also say that it is c times a. Times a hat, for example, because a hat just gives you the direction. So, for example, if I have a vector here, which is some vector d, then this would be a vector 10d. Same thing, magnitude's different by that factor 10. So, for example, if this is a, this is minus a. So here we've actually multiplied it by a constant minus 1, so that actually also flips the direction. Suppose this is A, which from your perspective is going straight up. Here is B. We do it about the same magnitude, roughly. So we had a smattering of hands that went up for 1, 3, and 4. Most of you said 2. So let's look at that for a moment. We have A this way. Minus B would correspond to a vector that goes like so. So that would be plus minus B is the way to think about it. And then the resultant would look like that. So the right answer here would be number two. Okay. So as many of you may have noticed that this is really, so far, much too easy and unlikely to provide job security for physicists. So it is important that we now do what we can to obfuscate the obvious. We could do A plus B plus C. You can get by taking A plus B and then taking that resultant, adding it to C. So we can get a vector by making it out of the sum of its three component vectors. So one of which would be, say, a vector here, which I'll call AX. One of which would be a vector here, which I'll call AY. And the third is a vector here, which I can call AZ. So although we had talked about how the vector A here is really a triplet of numbers, which is made up of the three scalars, which is how far out you are in X, how far out you are in Y, how far out you are in Z. But I can also think of it as being made up of the three vectors. One vector being the vector A sub X, which is really sitting on this line. It's not offset. The other being vector Y this way, and then the vector Z up that way, all added together. Yes? Yes. This is Z, and this is Y. Yeah. So in this case, the magnitude of the vector AX is exactly the same as that X component of the number of the triplet that defines where the point is at the end of vector A. But its direction now is given along the X-axis by definition. And similar for Y and Z. So, that means we can think of A as equal to a triplet of numbers, AX, AY, AZ. Or we could think of A as equal to AX magnitude. I should also say that should be equal to a number AX multiplied by a vector in the X direction, a unit vector in the X direction, plus AY multiplied by a unit vector in the Y direction, plus AZ multiplied by a unit vector in the Z direction. So I can think of this A as being the vector sum of these three vectors, or the resultant of those three vectors. It is also just this triplet of numbers, but if I think of it as the vector sum of these three vectors, then I might write it like that. But that's too obvious. So we're going to take X hat, and we're going to call it I hat. We're going to take Y hat, and we're going to call it J hat. And we're going to take Z hat, and we're going to call it K-hat. And you might ask why. And I can't give you a good reason. It is just done. And it's quite conventional. And you may see books that will do it this way, or they'll do it that way. So if you see something that's an I hat, it is basically a unit vector in the X direction. You see the A hat is a unit vector in the Y direction, and you see the K hat is a unit vector in the Z direction. So, using that notation, you can rewrite this as A is equal to AX in the I hat plus B, AY in the J hat plus AZ in the K hat direction. This is the same as A is equal to the magnitude of AX vector in the I hat direction plus the magnitude of AY vector in the J hat direction plus the magnitude of AZ in the K hat direction, etc. Okay, so lots of different ways to basically give you to write the same thing. So now what I'd like to do is to look at the addition of vectors again, but I want to now be analytical about it. I want to actually calculate what these numbers are. And this is really how you're going to do it for the rest of the semester. And at first it's going to seem really unwieldy, and it will make you ponder whether or not you should go drop this course because of how painful it is at first. But the truth is you'll actually get very used to it very fast, and before long you'll just be doing it quickly and automatically, okay? So we have to think about it, though. The vector is made up of, in a three-dimensional world, is made up of these three components, right, that we've seen now described in several different ways. So if we want to do vector addition, what we'd like to do is that the problem is it's all this directional stuff that gets complicated. Okay? It's a little hard to know how to add something in this direction with something in that direction as they are. So what we do is we look at the piece of this one that is of in this direction, and we can add it to the piece of this one that's in this direction, and now the direction is easy because it's just an algebraic sum. Okay? So what we do, in principle, is we take the vectors and we break them up into their components along each of the dimensions. We can add those now algebraically, and then recombine everything to see what we end up with. So that's the basic philosophy. So that means we have to be able to break vectors into their components along the primary axes. So I'm going to do two dimensions right now. In the plane of the paper, let's say we have a vector A here. And as we have seen already, we can think of this vector A as being made up of a vector AX and a vector AY. Right? This is the same thing as the magnitude of AX in, say, the X-hat direction plus the magnitude of AY in the Y-hat direction. So you can see, when you picture it in terms of its components, this magnitude plays a special role because this magnitude gives you that number along that axis. Okay. So if you look at this, what you have is a right triangle. And you have very particular rules that you learned in high school. And if you were like me, you learned a lot of crap in high school and you wondered why in the world anyone cared. And this was one of those things for me. Lots of trick stuff. I could do it okay, but I never understood why I should care about it until I did lots of calculus and physics and began to realize why these things are useful. So this you've seen before, I'm sure, or you ought not be sitting there. Whether you've seen it or not, I want you to get real good at it now. So if you have a right triangle and you have an angle between two of the sides, then I call the side that is short and adjacent to the angle, I call this the adjacent side. The long side is the hypotenuse, and the short side that's opposite the angle, I creatively call the opposite side. Okay? And by definition, really, the sine of theta is equal to the opposite over the hypotenuse in terms of magnitudes. Okay? This now is a number over a number. Gives you a sort of unitless thing if they have units. The cosine of the angle is equal to the adjacent over the hypotenuse, and the tangent of the angle is equal to opposite over the adjacent. So if we look at this vector problem, we can think of this as a triangle, right? And we can define the vector A by defining its magnitude and its direction. And in this two-dimensional problem, we can define its direction in terms of its angle with respect to the x-axis. So if this is a triangle, then the magnitude of A squared is equal to the magnitude of AX squared plus the magnitude of AY squared by Pythagorean, right? That's C squared equals A squared plus C squared. So that gives us the magnitude if we have the components. And then we can know, depending on what we know about this problem, the sine of the angle theta is equal to the magnitude of AY over the magnitude of A, which we calculate from above, right? The cosine of theta is equal to AX magnitude over AY. I'm sorry, not AY, but A. And the tangent of theta is equal to AY magnitude over AX magnitude. Are you excited yet? Okay. I'm going to come back to this probably repeatedly, but note, for example, that if this were a projectile problem and A was a vector that described the initial velocity of a ball, right? So the ball starts out going that way, so it does this kind of motion, right? It is very natural, when you first look at such a problem, to define its initial angle as the angle with the horizontal, right here. So when you do that, then when you look for the equations that describe the vertical and horizontal motion, for the vertical, you relate this angle and that velocity, you end up pulling out the sine theta component. And for the horizontal, you end up pulling out the cosine theta component. Your book even gives you equations with cosine theta in there. If you get into the habit of using cosine theta because it's a projectile problem, what are you going to do if I were to give you this angle instead of that angle? Then every cosine theta should be a sine theta, and you're just dead wrong. Right? So the caution is, when you do lots of problems, you're going to begin to fall into habits of using certain components. Never get comfortable with that. Always, always, always go back to these, the opposite over adjacent, the opposite over hypotenuse, and the adjacent over hypotenuse. You've got to go back to those every time you're doing anything breaking a vector into components. If you don't, you're going to start getting a 50-50 shot. Seriously. So it's a very common thing for people to do in this class. So I just want to, when we get to some of the problems, we'll look at it more carefully. Okay. So let's look at how one actually adds two vectors together analytically. So let's say here's y, here's x, and let's say I have a vector b, which is straight down, and we're going to say the magnitude of b is equal to 5 meters, and then we'll say vector a is like this, where this angle is 20 degrees. Let's say the magnitude of A is, say, 4 meters. And the problem then is to find the resultant A plus B. Okay? So in order to do this analytically, what we want to do is decompose vectors into components along axes. Add these components algebraically. Along each axis, and then recombine. All right, so that's the basic strategy. So if you look at B, B already has only one component. It has only a piece along Y. So B is basically already decomposed into things along. So for B, it happens to be a long Y. So B, the magnitude of B in the Y is also written as B in the Y. So this is another thing I don't think I mentioned before. Very often, you can write the magnitude of a vector this way, it's sort of very obvious then, but very often, if you just take away the arrow, this would represent the magnitude. So these are really the same thing. And in this case, it's equal to 5 meters, and B in the X is equal to 0. That's magnitude. And you have to remember that it is, when we add things together, you have to worry about the direction, but we'll get there in a second. Oh, let me do this whole thing. So we have A here, which is a magnitude of 4 meters and has an angle here of 20 degrees. So a way to think of that is here is A. Here is A in the X. And here is A in the Y. And this is your angle. So the sine of theta is going to be equal to the magnitude of AY over the magnitude of A. Which means that the magnitude of AY is equal to A times the sine of theta. So if you know the magnitude of A, which we do, and you know the angle, you can calculate the size of the component along Y. And in this case, that also comes in with a minus sign. The magnitude is given by this. But when we add it algebraically to something else, it also comes in with a minus sign. Cosine theta is equal to AX magnitude over A. So AX is equal to A times the cosine of theta. And so far these are magnitudes. So now we want to add things together. So the resultant vector magnitude in the x direction, well, let me give it a sign now. The magnitude of the resultant in the x direction is now going to be the vector sum of the two of the pieces that I have along x. And the magnitude of the resultant in the y direction will be the sum of the pieces that I have in y. But now, pretty much, you can just do it in your head because it has to be, all you have is an algebraic sign. So in the x direction, B doesn't contribute at all, so there's zero, which means the resultant in x is going to be just this component of the A vector, and it's going to be in the negative direction. So it will be the magnitude of A times the cosine of the angle in the x hat direction, and it's negative because it's going in the negative direction. Are you following me? In Y, I have this piece. That's the magnitude of B that is negative. And I have the piece here for A, which is positive, so it goes in the opposite direction. All right, and they basically cancel each other out to some extent. So Ry turns out to be minus the magnitude of B. B in the Y, if you will, which is the same as B, plus, because the other vector is in the positive direction, the magnitude of A times the sine of the angle theta, because that projects out the vertical piece. And this whole thing is now in the y-hat direction. And whether it points up or down depends on which of these two things went out, which has a larger magnitude. In this case, this will be bigger, but that's not a priori obvious unless you analyze the problem. ready to shoot yourselves yet? Believe me, this becomes very automatic, so it's not a big deal after a while. Okay. So, where? Did I take out the wrong component? Let's see. Rx should be project off this component of A, so it should come A times cosine theta, should be in the x half and negative. Ry should have the minus b, because that's all we have that way, and it should have the positive sine theta component of A. So I think these are okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was wrong.
Okay. All right. So now we sort of have to add things together, okay? So graphically, just to get a sense of whether you think you're right or not, we want to add A plus B, and A is out like this, roughly, and B is down like that, roughly. So what you would expect to find is some resultant that looks something like that, okay? So it's going to have probably a negative x component and a negative y component, I guess, is how I would mentally think of it. So let's see what happens. We have the magnitude of A is 4 and the magnitude of B is 5. So the x component of R is minus 4 times the cosine of 20, and the y that's going to be equal minus 5 plus 4 sine of 20, and it will be in the y hat direction. And the magnitude of R total is the magnitude Rx squared plus, is this the square of the magnitude of the total resultant is the square, the sum of the squares of the two components. So now it just becomes putting in numbers, okay? And so this gives you the x component size, the y component size, and the total magnitude. And so you'll end up with something if you can imagine. You'll have some Rx out like this. You'll have an Ry, which turns out to be negative. And so you'll have some vector R that's the sum of these two. And you'll have some angle here because you have to define it. So if I say I want to define the resultant, one piece I need is the magnitude, which I get from this equation. And the other piece I need is to be able to tell you the direction, and I have to define that in some way. So I can define it by saying it will be so many degrees down from the minus y-axis. That would be the definition of the direction, for example. And you can find how many degrees that is by realizing that the tangent of this psi is equal to the magnitude Ry over the magnitude of, over Rx. You're fine if you define it as the angle here. Doesn't matter, but you just have to be very careful how you define it. If I use this angle, then these would be slope. because it's a different animal. Questions sort of on this. I mean, it just takes practice to get used to it. You want to be careful after a while, it sort of becomes second nature, but always be cautious as you're doing it, because it's pretty easy to make mistakes. Yes? X hat and Y hat, by definition, have magnitudes 1. That's the number that's associated with it. So I guess what I'm saying is when you add vectors A and B together, you'll end up with a vector that has an X component, which is the algebra, basically the sum of those two X components of the other vectors, and you'll have a Y component that's the sum of the two Y components. And now these are the X and Y components of that final vector. Yeah. Yes.
How do you want us to name the angle?
There's no easy answer to that. You have to specify a direction somehow, and then the problem, there's often sort of an obvious way to do it, but you can maybe choose others. So very often it might be angle up from the horizontal, or angle, you know, away from north towards east, or something like that. And then you have to...
Descriptive?
I'm sorry, I don't know where you are. Yeah.
So, descriptive?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can even use English, yeah.
Like, for example, could you say, like, you know, 180 plus 45 degrees?
Yeah, you could say angle from the positive x-axis in the clockwise in the counterclockwise direction. You could do that.
So you just, as long as you just describe what you're saying.
Yeah. So there are multiple right ways to do it, and they're all basically equivalent. Usually, though, I discourage you from thinking in terms of large angles, because it's very easy to get into quadrant troubles with things like tangents on your calculator and things like that. So mentally, I always sort of stay within the 90 degree region. And so I will define them almost always as, you know, so many degrees counterclockwise from the negative y-axis or something like that. Okay, that's how I normally do it. For simplicity. Okay, so now we really have our tools to begin to think about three-dimensional motion. So imagine that I have an object of some sort at some point in space, and in some given instant, this object happens to be to have a velocity, say, that's going this way, maybe happens to be undergoing an acceleration that is in some other direction, maybe, say, like this. And it's clearly at some point in space, but we've already seen I can define points in space by a vector. So the point in space is really three numbers. So I can define that by this vector, which I'm going to call S. S is often used to be sort of a generic position measurement. Because it's not really along X, and it's not along Y, it's not along Z. It could be in principle, but it's not. Okay, so I have to have some general coordinate. Usually we choose S. Very often if you're talking about length along the circle, the arc length or whatever, you call that S if you're, you know, used to that from calculus. So here is this thing. And all of these things might be changing with time. So at any given moment, S as a function of t is equal, has an x component in the I hat direction, a y component in the j hat direction, and a z component in the k hat direction. And if I take the derivative of S with respect to time, then I get the derivative of S in the X with respect to time in the I hat direction, plus the derivative of S in the Y in the J hat direction, plus the derivative of S in the Z with respect to time in the K hat direction. But this is what we know as the velocity as a function of time. And this is v in the x, v in the y, all of which are functions of time, v in the z. Similarly, you have the acceleration, which would be the derivative of each of these components. Okay, so having said that, I guess I should put a, since I'm doing three axes in the equations, I should probably do a z here. So now you can have a problem where an object is moving in some general motion in three dimensions, and at any given moment, it will have a position, a velocity, and acceleration in three dimensions. You can break them into the three one-dimensional pieces and solve for the motion and feed it back together. So that's really how one does sort of the three-dimensional pieces. So again, I think at this stage it looks pretty horrible. So let me try to give you a little bit of a better feeling for it. Here's if I just take a ball and I throw it, okay? What do we know? We know that the force of gravity near the surface of the Earth on the ball is constant, which I haven't proven to you, but I've just basically told, okay? If we say F equals ma, then the thinking is that that means the acceleration in the direction toward the center of the Earth, or the vertical direction in this problem, is always going to be constant and toward the center. So horizontally, in the limit of no air friction, there's no acceleration. Okay? So A in the X is zero. Now I happen to be showing you the one that has no acceleration on it. So here's the one with acceleration. So if you just think about the pink, the acceleration vector is a function of time, has no component along the x because there's no force along the x, and it is constant at every point of motion in the downward direction in this particular problem. Okay? These vectors are all related. I start out with a particular motion, And the vectors evolve according to whatever the forces and things that are on them. And we actually just established that with the acceleration. So if we, given that that is the acceleration, let's look and see what happens to, for example, the velocity. What do I know about the velocity? I know that the velocity is I know that the acceleration is the rate of change of the velocity. So if the acceleration is zero in the horizontal direction, then what it means is that the velocity has to be constant in the horizontal direction. So if we look at the vectors on this ball as a function of time as it moves along, initially you have a velocity vector that is at some angle theta zero, okay? I can break that into components, into the vertical and horizontal. The reason I do that is because I can understand things in the vertical and horizontal. I have no idea what's going on in some weird angle. But I do know in the horizontal what the acceleration is, and I know in the vertical what the acceleration is, which means I can make some sense of what's happening with those components. So a way to think about it is when I break this initial velocity up into the horizontal and the vertical and the horizontal, the acceleration in the horizontal direction is zero because there's no force that way, which means this component of the velocity is constant. It is not changing from picture to picture to picture. The velocity in the vertical direction, however, has to change, and it has to change at a constant rate because I have a constant acceleration in that direction. What do we know? We know we start with a large velocity going up. It gets smaller, smaller, smaller. At the top of the motion, it has no upward velocity. That's how we define pop. And then it begins to come down. Excuse me. Which means the velocity vector begins to grow and grow and grow. So what do you see? Here's the v0y is large. Here you have it going up, but it's smaller. Here it's zero. Then it starts to grow going down. Okay? And if you look at the total velocity vector as a function of time, it is the sum vectorially of these two component vectors. So at the top, for example, you have no upward or downward motion velocity-wise, but you do have this horizontal. And look at the total velocity vector. It is nothing but this original vx that you started with. And there is zero component up and down. And as you go, look at how they change. You always have this constant vx to the side, and you have this big vector that gets smaller, that goes to zero, and now starts to go the other way. And look at what happens to the total velocity vector. The total velocity vector is the vectorial sum of these two things, okay? Here, you have small vx, big vy, and you get something that sort of looks like that. Here you have same vx, a smaller vy, and now you have something that has more of an angle off to the horizontal because this now is a larger contribution than it was down here. Over here, it's purely horizontal. Here, it starts to go down because now vy has a downward component, so as you add them together vectorially. You will notice that the path that you follow, which describes basically how to position S vector goes with time, you'll notice that it's sort of, notice that the path that you see here, the velocity vector is always tangential to it. Or has to be. So let me see if I can pull this up. No. All right, we'll do that next time. Anyway, we're done.